our heritage. How often those two words are used today when we speak of the need to conserve all that is best from the British past. We speak of heritage when we urge the conservation of our old towns and villages and their distinctive character. We speak of heritage when we ask for money to save or renovate great cathedrals or churches. British institutions, laws, customs and traditions are regarded as our heritage, as are our great works of literature, art, music, drama, and so on. Equally, our great works of engineering and science. It's still considered right and proper to treasure these things. It's still thought correct to pass on to our children, at home and in the schoolroom, an appreciation of their value. And rightly so. Of all parties, we in the new National Front are the most strongly committed to the defence of Britain's heritage and to the task of educating each new generation in its importance. But we go further. We ask why it is that, in the midst of this concern to preserve the heritage of Britain, nothing is said or done about the most important of all aspects of this heritage, the British people themselves. Nowhere do we hear the cry that the British people must be preserved and nourished for the sake of future generations. Nowhere do we hear the protest that the British people could be in danger of extinction. Nowhere do we hear the leaders of the established political parties sound the alarm at the threat to the survival of our people, as they do at the threat to villages, churches, statues, stately homes, works of art, festivals, and the countryside. Yet what would we have in the way of these treasures, were it not for the fact that preceding them were the British people? Who created all the works of beauty around us but the British people, and in a few cases their racial cousins in Europe? Who built our villages and churches? Who produced our great literature? Who made our land fertile? To whom do we owe all those national traditions and institutions that are of value? Did they just grow out of the ground? No. They are the legacy that we have inherited from ancestors of a special genius. People created them. Without people of a unique quality, a unique aptitude, there would be no British heritage as we know it. Our land would be a wilderness. Our villages and towns would consist of mud huts. Our art would consist of primitive scrawlings. Our literature would speak to us in grunts. We would have no feats of engineering and science. And almost certainly, we would at some time in the past have been defeated in battle and conquered, without even a country today to call our own. Therefore, I must ask, how seriously can we really take those folk who make passionate speeches and write passionate articles about the conservation of our heritage, who form societies to preserve this and that, when those same folk say nothing and do nothing about the threat to our most precious heritage of all, the people who built Britain and who pushed the frontiers of British civilization to the furthest corners of the world? It's time we redress this balance and recognize the British people as our foremost asset. It's time that we understood that should all our national heritage of man-made things be destroyed, so long as the British people survived, this heritage could be created again just as our ancestors created it. But should the British people be destroyed, whether through annihilation in war or through being bred out of existence by a gradual process of racial selection, that heritage will be lost. I spoke a moment ago about those who pushed the frontiers of British civilization to the furthest corners of the world. This is something we must not forget. Too often when we talk of our countrymen, our compatriots, we're thinking just of the people who today live in Britain. But why should we omit those whose blood is of our blood, whose race is of our race, who today live overseas? In the Americas, in Australasia, in Southern Africa. People who come from stock that originated in these islands. Are they any the less a part of the heritage of the British people because they were among those who expanded the domains of the British Crown in previous centuries? Is there not something quite absurd in the fact that today we are told we should regard Negroes and Asians as part of our own people, but Canadians of British stock as another people, a foreign people? Is it not extraordinary that our present citizenship laws are framed accordingly, with almost everyone living in Britain being regarded as British, but those many millions of British race overseas being regarded otherwise? Take the huge country of Australia. A comparatively short span of history ago, this was an almost empty wilderness, populated by only a few savages. It's now one of the most highly developed countries in the world. This is because British people one day landed there and settled there, and with their descendants built a civilization. Should this civilization now be thought of as not part of our heritage, simply because it's thousands of miles away? And should the Notting Hill Carnival now be thought of as part of our heritage, because it takes place close to the center of London? There are many who think so. It's the fashionable thing today to think so. Because the term heritage, like so much of our language, has fallen into distorted use. Let's look for a moment at the Americas, North and South America. Both those areas represent a rich heritage of land, of natural beauty and natural resources. But there the similarity ends. In every other aspect of the heritages of those two parts of the American continent, there's a striking difference. From Mexico down to Cape Horn, there is, for the most part, poverty and squalor. There are few stable institutions. There's constantly revolution and civil war. Then look at North America. What a contrast. One of the highest living standards in the world. The world's most advanced technology. Food production that caters not only for the 240 million of that semi-continent, but a great deal of the rest of the world as well. Why has North America, Canada and the United States been so successful, while Latin America has been such a failure? There's no doubt as to why. Latin America was colonized by Spaniards and Portuguese. Whatever the caliber of those original colonizers, and they included some people of very high caliber indeed, their descendants mixed and integrated with Indians and Negroes and produced a half-breed population. In Canada and the United States, the colonizers and pioneers were mainly Anglo-Saxons, people from the British Isles. Today, the leading ethnic groups in both those countries are still the Anglo-Saxons. Over the centuries, the Anglo-Saxons of North America haven't mixed their blood, and we can see the fruits of this wisdom in the tremendous vitality and energy of the civilization that they've created. Just two generations ago, schoolchildren in this country were taught to look at the map of the world and see the huge part of it colored with the red of the British Empire. Since then, the British Empire has been destroyed, willfully dismantled by the criminal folly and treason of British politicians. And we can now no longer see that empire on the map of the world. But one thing has not changed. We can still find on the map enormous areas of the Earth's surface which, as a matter of historical fact, were colonized and developed by people of British stock, and in which the most important population groups today are those of British stock, in which by far the greatest contribution to development and construction has come from people of British stock, in which the main cultural imprint has been made by people of British stock. Canada, and the United States, representing a combined area of nearly 7.5 million square miles, 79 times the area of the United Kingdom. Australia and New Zealand, a combined area of over 3 million square miles, 32 times the area of the United Kingdom. So here we have two areas of the world which together make up well over 100 times the area of this country. And throughout these two enormous continents, the predominating race is British. I say this not forgetting that there are more non-British people in both parts of North America than there are British today, so long as we're thinking in pure numerical terms. When I speak of the predominating race, I mean that the British race accounts for a much larger part of the population than any other single ethnic group. And I mean also that the share contributed by this race towards the development and achievements of the two countries of North America is much more than half. We talk about the American conquest of outer space and the American landing on the moon. American these things are, but not any type of American. A brief look at the names of the men who took part in this conquest of space show that most of them were of British descent, Anglo-Saxons. A brief look at the background of scientific research that made their conquest possible, the whole brilliant achievement of rocketry, shows that the predominating role was played by Anglo-Saxons and Germans. When we look at these enormous areas of the world of Anglo-Saxon settlement, and when we consider that throughout those areas there must be well over 100 million people of Anglo-Saxon race, in addition to the 50 million plus that we have in the United Kingdom today, it gives us an idea of the sheer magnitude of the Anglo-Saxon achievement. No race in history has anything to offer to equal it. And yet of this achievement there is very little spoken today, very little taught in schools. Very little awareness of this vast inheritance impinges upon our consciousness as a people. When we speak of our heritage, how often is this mentioned? There's another thought that should surely emerge from a consideration of the Anglo-Saxon impact upon these huge areas of the world, and from the numbers of Anglo-Saxons now settled in them. This is of the immense power that would today be wielded by the Anglo-Saxon race had it remained the cohesive unit that it was in the earlier days of its expansion across the seas from the British Isles. It would be a power that no other race could match. It would guarantee our safety and security for untold centuries to come. Yet among Anglo-Saxons today there is no cohesion. There is no cohesion because there is no sense to begin with of common destiny, of common race, of common nationhood. Of all the ethnic groups in the world, the Anglo-Saxons are perhaps the weakest in ethnic consciousness. In the United States, almost every other ethnic community is organized for the protection of its interests, organized to wield political muscle, organized to keep alive its culture and arts and to maintain its links with the land of its origin. The Poles, the Mexicans, the Puerto Ricans, the Catholic Irish, the Italians, the Greeks, the Chinese and Japanese, the Negroes, above all, the Jews. Only the Anglo-Saxons have no such organization. The result is that the people who contributed by far the most to the building of America, and who even today contribute the most to the upkeep of America, are losing the struggle for power in America. This same weak ethnic sense can be seen in Anglo-Saxons throughout the rest of the world. In Britain, we meekly tolerate the colored invasion of our homeland. In Australia and New Zealand, the same type of invasion is now taking place with the full approval of governments. And it actually is now harder to get into Australia if you're Anglo-Saxon than if you're Asian or black. the same process is at work in Canada. And not only that. In Canada, the French, who lost the original struggle for that country on the heights of Abraham over 200 years ago, are assertive and on the ascendant, while the Anglo-Saxons are passive and on the retreat. The reason? The French are spurred on by a powerful ethnic nationalism, while the Anglo-Saxons, though far more numerous, are for the most part good little one-world liberals who've forgotten their identity, their destiny, their history. Very recently, we witnessed another appalling surrender of Anglo-Saxon power in Rhodesia. The collapse of Rhodesia and the events that led up to it was a saga of shame that exemplified all the worst vices and weaknesses of the Anglo-Saxon in the 20th century. First, the white Rhodesians' motherland, Britain, turned against them and dedicated herself to their downfall, with many British politicians actually supporting the terrorists who were engaged in killing Anglo-Saxon civilians and children. Then the Anglo-Saxons in Rhodesia itself, after they'd managed to weather the storm without the support of their kinfolk in Britain, tamely consented to a black government on the promise, as it turned out a false promise, that their jobs and their living standards wouldn't be affected. This tragedy would never have occurred had the Anglo-Saxons, both in Rhodesia and Britain, thought racially. In that case, the white Rhodesians would have been determined to remain in control, not primarily for the sake of their jobs and living standards, but out of a sense of national self-preservation, out of a sense of destiny. And Britain, instead of working for their downfall, would have supported them, out of a sense of common race. But this weak racial instinct of the Anglo-Saxons is not really new. It dates right back to the American War of Independence, for that was the first great division that took place between British peoples. There's no question that the peoples of the American colonies had justified grievances against the British Crown. There's no question that in time the structure of government of the empire would have had to have been adjusted to meet their requirements as free and equal citizens of that empire, with the right to control their local affairs. But did these issues necessitate the severance of the ties of race and family? Could not greater statesmanship on both sides of the Atlantic have achieved an amicable settlement of that quarrel without the breakup of the family and the divergence of destinies that followed? And when Americans of the original stock look at their country today, with its motley of races, all scrambling for power and predominance, with its tragic disunity and the impotence that comes of that disunity, with its failure to gel together into a single nation, in the sense that Germany is a nation, in the sense that Spain is a nation, in the sense that Britain was, until recently, a nation? Could it not be that those Americans appreciate that much more binds them to Anglo-Saxons overseas than to Negroes, Mexicans, and Israelis residing within their own borders? After the British Empire lost America, it had the opportunity to learn the lessons of that catastrophe and prevent its recurrence. It had the opportunity to weld together the remaining lands of Anglo-Saxondom into a great union that would have endured for more than 1,000 years. A union that would have married together a people of the world's greatest skills with lands containing the world's greatest natural resources. A union that could today be in the forefront of the world's great powers. But that lesson was not learned, and that opportunity was not taken. Bit by bit, the other communities of Anglo-Saxondom were allowed to drift apart from the British mother country and apart from one another. Economics played a large part in this. The greedy merchants of Victorian Britain, with their lackeys in Westminster, put profits first and racial ties second. Preferential trade, one of the key elements in the binding together of empire and the peoples of empire, was never properly instituted. and never instituted for very long. Economic liberalism, the prevailing religion of the Liberal Party then, like the Tory Party now, always ruled the day. The economic development of the empire was never properly coordinated and never seriously pursued. The Anglo-Saxon communities overseas, left too often to their own devices by British governments, formed an independent outlook and began to look elsewhere for the alliances and trade they needed to survive and develop. The final recognition of the breakup of the British Empire has only come during the last 20 years. But the reality of that breakup occurred much earlier. That breakup need never have been. Other ethnic communities, equally dispersed, have clung together. The breakup of the British world took place because we allowed it. Because in the case of the Anglo-Saxons, water has proved too often to be thicker than blood. Yet, the Anglo-Saxon race remains. It may have dispersed itself over widely scattered territories. It may have devolved into several sovereign states. It may at the present time have little in the way of will to unity, let alone to greatness. But it remains. And out of it, something can still come. It all depends on whether, at this late hour, the Anglo-Saxon peoples can read properly the lessons of history and recognize that they have a heritage more vast and more splendid than all the peoples. And it depends on whether they see that heritage, first and foremost, not in terms of what Anglo-Saxon people have created, but in terms of the Anglo-Saxon peoples themselves, in terms of our great race. When we look around the world today, we find that other races don't suffer from the weak ethnic sense of the Anglo-Saxons. I mentioned how the French in Canada are asserting themselves and recognize that they're different from other Canadians. I mentioned the ethnic groups in the United States with their political lobbies and the way they trade their votes with politicians for services rendered in return. We have blacks in America and in Britain identifying with black Africa. We have Chinese scattered around the world but still remaining Chinese. We have Asians in this country, worshipping in their mosques and cooking their curry. Then finally we have the awesome power of Zionism, which links together Jews, whether they be in London, New York, Paris, Amsterdam, Stockholm, or Buenos Aires. Zionism it is that organizes and mobilizes the 20-odd million Jews of the world into a single community, a single nation, almost a single state, with a will and a system for protecting Jewish interests wherever they may be threatened. Zionism it is that has provided the Jewish community with the most highly developed defense and survival mechanism of any of the racial communities. The 160-odd million Anglo-Saxons have nothing to compare with it. Hence the Jews' strength and our weakness. We in the National Front, and more latterly the New National Front, have always advocated that the British people recognize the common heritage and destiny that we share with peoples of British stock elsewhere in the world. This has often led others to misunderstand us and claim that we seek to reinstate the British Empire that lies buried with Queen Victoria. Well, the reinstatement of that empire would be no bad thing if it were possible. But it isn't possible, and there's no point in talking as if it were. What we must now do is aspire to something new, something to serve the same purpose that the empire once served. What we aspire to in our movement is a great community of Anglo-Saxon peoples, a community that will begin where the empire left off, a community that will safeguard Anglo-Saxon interests and advance Anglo-Saxon power. We must somehow reconcile in this community the natural desire of its peoples to control their own affairs with the need overall to enable that community to be organized to defend its mutual interests and to speak with one voice in the affairs of the world. Throughout this message, I've used the term Anglo-Saxon interchangeably with the term British. I realize, of course, that neither term will satisfy everyone, and neither term can be regarded as exact. No ethnic term ever is. Nevertheless, the term Anglo-Saxon has at least the virtue of easy identification. Besides the English, it includes, of course, the Scots, the Welsh, the Ulster people, and their descendants overseas. There's no reason why it should not include the rest of the Irish, apart from that idiot minority that hates everything that comes from this side of the Irish Sea, despite the fact that the histories and cultures of Ireland and Britain are inextricably tied up together. I say this as one whose own family has been part of that very tie. Neither should it exclude other North Europeans, whose families have settled in Anglo-Saxon countries and integrated fully with the cultures and traditions of those countries. That the term Anglo-Saxon is not an exact one does not alter the fact that there are at least 160 million, and possibly up to 200 million people around the world who are willing to answer to that description, and who are given that description by others. We Anglo-Saxons live in a world that has not changed fundamentally since primitive man fashioned his first battle axe. It's still a world of struggle and conflict in which fortune favors the strong. Spasmodically, this struggle and conflict flares into violence, but at the best of times it continually takes place in the form of economic competition, with the peoples of the world competing for the resources of the world. This fact of life will not go away, however much it may be wished away by liberals and dreamers and the brotherhood of man. Even the liberals themselves are now telling us that the resources of planet Earth cannot indefinitely support the peoples of planet Earth, an assertion which is perfectly true, however false the deductions that liberals make from that assertion. However advanced and sophisticated our civilization may have become, we must never imagine that we, any more than primitive man, are exempt from the laws that govern human survival and extinction. These laws, as ever, demand that we make ourselves strong, or we perish. In the light of this, one must ask today, how strong are we? And one is bound to answer, not strong at all. The Anglo-Saxon race around the world is hopelessly divided, and everywhere it's led by people who are lacking in any powerful racial or national consciousness. People who will neither stand by their friends or stand up to their enemies. Everywhere the political institutions of the Anglo-Saxon peoples, shaped as they are by the alien ideals that spewed forth from the French Revolution, are inadequate to equip us and organize us for racial survival. And everywhere those institutions spawn leaders who are weak and corrupt, and ready to serve alien interests much more devotedly than they ever serve the interests of our own race. I've been convinced for many years that the Anglo-Saxon peoples need a movement, a worldwide movement, dedicated to their cause, as Zionism is dedicated to the Jewish cause. A movement that unites people of Anglo-Saxon blood, irrespective of the territories in which they live, or the states of which they happen at the moment to be citizens. A movement that educates our peoples, and particularly the younger generations, to a sense of their history and their destiny, and the determination to work, and if necessary, fight for that destiny. A movement that will work for change in the political institutions that have weakened the Anglo-Saxon peoples, and give to those peoples new institutions better adapted to their survival and growth. At this point, I would like to come back to the question of our heritage, and to reiterate that by far the most vital part of the heritage of any nation is its people. Only after that, its monuments, its towns and cities, its countryside, and its works of art. What is our society doing today? Whether it be in Britain or in other areas of the world where Anglo-Saxons predominate, to nurture this priceless heritage of people. Everywhere, society is encouraging us in the belief that racial mixture is a good thing, that we may intermarry and interbreed with Negroes, Asians, and others not of our kind. Everywhere, society is encouraging the import into our countries of races totally different to our own in the evolutionary scale, and who cannot either assimilate themselves into our heritage today or carry it on tomorrow. But that's not all. As fast as we are importing alien races into our Anglo-Saxon homelands, and as fast as they are multiplying their numbers with their prolific birth rate, sustained and helped on by the welfare system that we've created for their benefit, we ourselves are increasingly adopting the suicidal practice of birth control, which means, in effect, denying to future generations the very people those generations need if our heritage is to live on. And what could be greater folly than this? Throughout the Anglo-Saxon world, there are abundant spaces for our people to live in, for people 2, 3, and more times the number that we have now. There are abundant resources to sustain those people at high living standards. Of all the peoples in the world, we need the very least to limit our numbers. Instead of keeping down our birth rate, we should be seeking to increase it. Who stands to gain by a low birth rate among Anglo-Saxons? Everyone but the Anglo-Saxon people themselves. So when people speak of our heritage, let us answer them. Yes, we must do all possible to defend that heritage, but we must begin by defending and strengthening the most important part of that heritage, which is the Anglo-Saxon race. We must defend our race by preventing it interbreeding with alien races, and we must defend it by ensuring that we have enough children to maintain and increase our numbers in the future. In other ways, we must defend the heritage of the Anglo-Saxon race. We must see to it that our children grow up with a healthy appreciation of what is involved in military defense. Our young men must be ready and trained to bear arms in any emergency. Before that, they must be educated in the value of soldierly qualities. Not with the attitude of regarding war as a desirable end in itself, but with an appreciation that preparedness for war is a necessary condition of survival in all nations. No nation that is not prepared to fight for its existence will exist for very long. In the education of our young, we must combat the cowardly pacifism that permeates our schools and universities everywhere. And we must instill into them the readiness to defend their country and their people by holding before them the example of great heroes of the past who've done likewise. In our young, we must instill the virtues of manhood and womanhood, and we must teach these young to despise everything that is neither one nor the other, everything that is of indeterminate sex, as well as everything that is of indeterminate race. We must make sure that our young are strong and healthy in body, and trained as well in initiative and self-reliance. Education in Anglo-Saxon countries today does very little towards these things. Education today has another great shortcoming. In my opinion, the greatest shortcoming of all. Throughout the whole school curriculum, almost nothing is taught about the things that govern the rise and fall of nations, the rise and fall of empires. History records that a certain nation was powerful and successful during certain centuries, and then that it declined. But there is little serious analysis of how that nation became powerful and successful, and how it later declined. Yet this question should lie at the very core of history teaching, and not only of history teaching, but of all education. What, after all, is the first task of the education of any people, if not to train and equip and prepare that people for survival in this highly competitive world? And how can this task be undertaken if we don't start instilling into our people at a very early age what are the qualities needed for survival, by allowing them to learn from the examples of the past, of nations and empires that rose and then fell? Everywhere we look today, we see the Anglo-Saxon peoples of the world set on a suicide course. Everywhere we see them on the retreat before other races, less endowed than they, but more assertive, more aggressive, and with a stronger racial will. Much of the blame for this lies in the first place in the schoolroom, where we train our young people in the wrong attitudes, and when we form in them weak and sloppy ideas that have no place in the real world, except among peoples that want to die. To end this message, I come back to the theme on which I began, our heritage, and what we must do to defend it. Before we can defend anything, we must know first of all what it is that we're defending. We must know what we mean when we speak of our heritage. I hope I've convinced you that our heritage means, before anything else, our people. Not just the people of Great Britain, but the people of the whole of Anglo-Saxondom. Britain was the original heartland of the Anglo-Saxons, and still is, in a sense, the cultural heartland. But Britain today only represents a tiny part of the area of the world controlled by the Anglo-Saxon race, and perhaps a third of the population of the Anglo-Saxon race. No British future or destiny is conceivable in isolation from the rest of this great Anglo-Saxon world. Our Anglo-Saxon world is now at a crossroads. It can go forward to reach new heights and lead mankind, or it can go into oblivion. If it's going to go forward, I believe that it must first undergo revolutionary change within. Revolutionary change in its political institutions, and revolutionary change in many of its habits of thinking. And this revolution must first and foremost be a revolution against liberalism. Liberalism and everything that that loathsome philosophy means in terms of the self-hatred and self-destruction of our race. The Anglo-Saxon movement of which I've spoken. This message is for those who form the vanguard of that movement, of that revolution, wherever they may be. In this, the oldest of Anglo-Saxon lands, or in the newer parts of that vast world that Anglo-Saxons have made their own. The road we've chosen is long and hard. The struggle sometimes bitter and the disappointment sometimes great. But it's a road from which we'll never deviate. Our lives are now totally dedicated, before all else, to the cause of Anglo-Saxondom. And to the end of those lives, we shall work and fight so that that cause may eventually triumph. Victor Hugo once said, "Mightier than the tread of advancing armies is the power of an idea whose time has come." I believe that our time, the time of the Anglo-Saxons, is soon to come. And that all the great achievements tremendous though these are, will be but a prelude to what we shall achieve in the future as a united race, and a race that has recovered its will to live greatly. With this unity and with this will, no power on earth can stop us. The one enemy that can stop us is our own doubt in our own strength. Let that be our thought as we look to the future. Let that guide us in the fight for our heritage.